There's not a lot of national news that tends to emerge from rural Pike County, Ohio. But April 22nd, 2016 was very different. Investigators with local law enforcement discovered a massacre at a compound less than 30 miles from the Kentucky border. It was in a cluster of homes belonging to one family, the Roden family. Around 7 a.m. on that Friday morning, one of the victim's sisters arrived to feed the pets at one of the homes. She found two bodies inside and called 911. Before police showed up, she discovered two more. Her brother soon arrived and discovered a third crime scene. Police would find three more victims there. After another 911 call, a fourth crime scene, investigators discovered an eighth body at a residence in nearby Piketon Village. The story made national evening news reports.
In another important story tonight, police in southern Ohio have a dragnet out for a killer who executed eight members of one family. The murderer hunted down the extended family in several homes in a rural county.
Three young children, aged 3, 6 months, and 4 days old, were unharmed. Investigators found the 4-day-old in bed with her mother's body. In all, 7 adults and a 16-year-old were killed. It was like something out of a horror movie. No suspects immediately emerged. Wild speculation swirled.
CBS News has learned investigators are looking at the possibility a Mexican drug cartel killed 8 members of an Ohio family in a pre-planned execution.
But within Pike County, neighbors and those close to the deceased had a clear hunch about who may have been involved.
Whoever done it knowed the family, because there were two dogs there that would eat you up. But I ain't gonna say no more.
One thing was clear, though. Mark Weaver, Ohio's deputy attorney general at the time, put it well in a press conference.
I just might tell you this is just the most bizarre story I've ever seen in being involved in law enforcement.
Who would have wanted to kill 8 members of one family, go from house to house and methodically execute each one? On today's episode, we'll describe this unexpected story and its unbelievable outcome. This is Jillian, and in partnership with Law and Crime, you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 230. It's hard to stick with working out. I know that after I had my daughter, it was super difficult to continue to be motivated to get up early every morning and get a workout in. But Peloton made it a lot easier. They have on-demand classes, so you can sneak in a workout whenever you want, for however long you want it to be. And their instructors are incredibly motivating and make the workout fun. It got to the point where I looked forward to hopping on my bike in the mornings. You likely already know that Peloton makes bikes, but did you know they also make treadmills? And not just any treadmills. The Peloton Tread can adjust your speed and incline automatically. And Peloton Tread instructors have a variety of training backgrounds and styles of motivation for runners and walkers of all levels. You don't have to be a super athlete to enjoy Peloton. Try Peloton Tread risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial. Patricia Gallagher Newberry, who goes by Patty, is an enterprise and watchdog reporter with the Cincinnati Enquirer. Patty has covered nearby communities in Ohio for years and has watched today's case since it began.
So the Roden family is a large family in southern Ohio, southern rural Ohio, lived in Pike County and counties around there. The victims in the case included 7 members of the Roden family and 1 future member. All of them were related in some way. The future member was the fiance of one of the victims. So that's why we call her a future member.
Patty describes the Roden family as a hardworking rural family who made their living like a lot of folks in that part of the state. A lot of gig work, she called it, and part-time work. Chris Roden Sr. was the patriarch.
Chris Roden, as an example, was a key construction person at what's called Big Bear Family Resort, a campground in Lucasville, Ohio. So he worked there, but he also did scrap metal work. He had a bunch of cars all over his lot. He also had two marijuana grow sites on his property. So he was, you know, doing whatever he could to support his family.
The marijuana grow operation led investigators to speculate early on that drug cartels may have been responsible for the Roden murders. Individual farmers like Chris Roden aren't permitted to grow marijuana legally in Ohio. But according to Patty, it wasn't an uncommon side business in that part of the state. We've outlined the basics of the murders, but Patty gives some additional facts. It all started around 11 o'clock on the evening of April 21st, 2016.
The first two victims were shot in their trailer home in southern Ohio.
Investigators believe that the killers somehow drew Chris Roden Sr. out to his front porch under the cover of night. He became the first victim while standing outside his trailer door.
There are bullet holes in the trailer door. His arm is shredded by what is believed to be the first round. He falls backward into the home, and then he's shot 8 more times while he's lying on the floor of his home. His cousin was sitting inside the trailer.
Chris's cousin was Gary Roden. He worked with Chris and would often stay at his place.
And he ended up being shot 3 times close range in the head inside the trailer home. And then they were dragged into a back bedroom where they were discovered the next morning by a family member who came to feed the animals and otherwise kind of attend to the property that Chris Roden lived at. So they were the first two victims around 11 o'clock that night.
The next two victims lived right next door, close, not even a 5-minute walk. They were Chris's oldest son, Frankie, and his fiance, Hannah Hazel Gilley.
Frankie Roden and Hazel Gilley were shot in their beds with a child between them, their child between them, 6-month-old child, son. The child was unharmed, but was discovered the next morning when the other bodies were discovered, lying in a pool of blood between his deceased parents. They had both been shot at close range in the head. Frankie Roden shot 3 times, and Hannah Gilley shot 5 times as they lay in their bed. So they became the next two victims.
After that, the killers traveled to the home of Dana Manley Roden, Chris's ex-wife. They were reportedly still on good terms while continuing to raise their teenage children, but they were no longer living together.
The first shooting at that scene was of Dana as she was sitting in her bed. I don't know the exact time, but it was middle of the night-ish. She had worked a double shift. She was still awake. She was scrolling Facebook on her phone in her bed.
Dana lived with their daughter, 19-year-old Hannah Mae Roden, and son, little Chris Roden, who was 16. Hannah Roden had 2 small kids of her own, a 3-year-old daughter she shared with her ex-boyfriend, who wasn't at the home at the time, and a newborn daughter with her current boyfriend.
She was in bed with her 5-day-old infant. That child was also left unharmed when Hannah Roden was shot and killed in her bed. Dana Roden, the mother, was shot 5 times in the head, and Hannah Roden 2 in the head. In the same trailer home, just down through the living room and down a different hallway, was the brother, the son of Dana Roden and the brother of Hannah Roden. His name is Chris Roden also. They called him Little Chris. He was 16 years old, and he was shot point blank in his bed, and he suffered 4 head injuries. He was killed by 4 gunshot wounds to the head. So that is crime scene number 3.
The killers then traveled to the trailer home of Kenneth Roden, who was Chris Sr.'s brother. Kenneth lived just a little bit away on a different street. The killers shot him through a window.
So that was the progression, the four different scenes, three different trailer homes, and then the fourth was truly a camper in the woods. Very rural, very isolated, not many neighbors around. This is a stretch of rural Pike County that's just off of Highway 32 as you go from north to south, or excuse me, east to west across the state of Ohio. Not many neighbors nearby, certainly no businesses or others who would hear the sound of gunshot in the wilderness.
The remoteness of the properties ensured that it took many hours for the grisly scene to be discovered. Bobby Jo Manley, Dana's sister, arrived at Chris Sr.'s house on the morning of April 22nd to feed the animals, something she did for her former brother-in-law often. He paid her for it.
She arrives and things seem just a little bit off. Some of the dogs were usually inside or outside, and some of the outside dogs are inside. And so she goes in to the trailer to check on things. And also, I believe Chris's car is home, and often he would already be gone to work when she came to feed the animals. And so she just, you know, went up to the front door, as you would for a family member, and went in and discovered in the very front, you know, that there was blood in the living room. There was a drag mark from the living room to the bedroom, and she discovered the bodies of her brother-in-law, Chris Roden, and his cousin, Gary Roden, in a back bedroom.
Bobby Jo called 911 immediately.
Man, let me tell you what's going on. There's blood all over the house. My brother-in-law's in the bedroom, and I beat the hell out of him.
She had a couple of friends with her that morning. They fanned out and started checking on other family members. They called 911, too. They discovered multiple scenes right near each other. Then later, Kenneth was discovered. The remaining members of the Roden family were understandably aghast, terrified. Geneva Roden, the family matriarch, pleaded with the public.
If there's someone out there that knows anything about what happened, would they please, please come forward?
The story became a national curiosity, a national tragedy. As soon as the 911 calls came in and it was clear that there was more than one victim, journalists began to flock to Pike County. Imagine the horror that spread through the community. This was a gruesome, grisly, targeted multi-murder in a small community. And it seemed like there were no immediate suspects.
People were panicked. They did not know if there was a madman on the loose. Nobody could have imagined why the Roden family would be killed in the dark of night. Not one, not two, but eight different related people. There was no immediate understanding of why this had happened or who might have done it.
Theories began to emerge, including the one about drug cartels.
That did come up early, cartels, although seemed somewhat unlikely given that the children, there were three different children in the four different crime scenes. The children were spared. The dogs were spared. None of the animals were killed. And the line of thinking was, well, if this was really like the Mexican cartel, wouldn't everybody be dead, right? Why would anybody be spared?
In the wake of the horrific Roden murders, another local family, the Wagner family, began to emerge as possibly having been involved in the killings.
So the Wagner family is a family of four: Billy Wagner, his wife Angela Wagner, and their two young adult sons, George and Jake. Billy Wagner was a man of some means for that part of the state. His mom and dad have a horse breeding business called the Flying W Farms. It's in Lucasville, Ohio. So that's where he was raised. Lucasville, Ohio is Pike County area. And so that family large landowners, a couple of thousand acres, and mostly what they do is breed horses and other kinds of exotic animals. So he came from, you know, some amount of wealth. He built his own life outside of his family of origin in the truck business. He was a driver, a long-haul driver, but he also was a low-level thief.
According to Patty, Billy, the father, was very suspicious of authority.
I did a lot of things like steal fuel, steal the loads off of semis, steal vending machine cash, etc.
Billy married Angela Carter Wagner when they were in their early 20s.
She worked on and off, but didn't really have a profession of her own, mostly identified as a homemaker. Then they had the two boys, George first, and then Jake. They're now 31 and 30. At the times of the crime, go back 6.5 years, they were early in their early to mid-20s. They homeschooled the two boys. They lived on rural property that they farmed. They raised animals. Angela had a dog breeding business at some point. I think they had some chickens and pigs and other kinds of common animals that they could potentially make money off of. They did not raise any crops, but they had, you know, they had farmhouses on large pieces of land that they used in various ways.
George and Jake, after they finished their homeschooling, ended up going to trade school to learn how to drive trucks. George was good with his hands, a skilled mechanic after he took his training. He knew a lot about cars and engines. Both George and Jake ended up working for an over-the-road trucking company based in that part of the state.
And they drove all kinds of loads all over the country for a couple of years. And they drove together, actually, where they could drive 24 hours, one at the wheel for 12 hours, the other at the wheel for 12 hours. That was their existence.
The four Wagner family members lived together. They worked as a unit and made their financial decisions as a unit. Angela Wagner seemed to be the ringmaster who kept people organized. Billy Wagner spent less and less time in the family home and spent a lot of his time at his mother's home.
His father was ill and dying, and so Billy spent a lot of time at the Flying W Farms, helping there or taking care of the father, etc. It was a volatile family from what was presented in court. They yelled at each other a lot of obscenities, a lot of arguing over day-to-day transactions, how to live their lives and what to do.
But what would make the Wagner family suspects in the murders of the Rodins? The Rodin and Wagner families had a very important, if complicated, relationship. Billy and Angela's son, Jake Wagner, became involved with Chris Sr. and Dana's daughter, Hannah Mae Rodin.
The connection begins when Jake Wagner, as a 17-year-old, meets Hannah Rodin when she's 13 at the fair, the county fair.
According to court testimony, Hannah had been raising pet bunnies as part of a 4-H project, and she was showing them at the fair. She met Jake there and started following him around.
And she's kind of following him around because he's a few years older, and she's like, pet my bunny, pet my bunny. And that's how they first met. And shortly thereafter, they strike up, a relationship.
Jake asked for permission to date Hannah. She was 13, he was 17. Hannah's father, Chris Rodin, granted permission for the two to date. Their early dates were chaperoned by one of Hannah's siblings. But at 15, Hannah became pregnant. At some point in all this, the two fathers, Billy Wagner and Chris Rodin Sr., became really good friends.
They start, talking, hanging out, but doing things together, stopping by each other's homes. Hey, I got a part. Do you have a part? Whatever that looks like. But as all I know is that they started becoming friendly with each other, the two fathers. And in testimony, it was said several times that Billy Wagner considered Chris Rodin his best friend.
Whether they were really best friends or not, 2.5 years from the night of the Rodin murders, multiple members of the Wagner family were arrested and charged with the murders.
More than a year later, in November 2018, Billy, Angela, George, and Jake Wagner were charged with the murders. The attorney general said the murders were planned meticulously, with the Wagners hacking into the Rodens' social media accounts to surveil them. The motive? Custody of the little girl that Jake Wagner shared with Hannah Roden.
According to the indictment filed in Pike County, the murders began as a custody dispute. Jake and Hannah had their daughter in 2013, but they didn't stay together. The relationship allegedly deteriorated over Jake's attempts to control what Hannah did and the decisions she made about their daughter. Hannah eventually moved on with a new boyfriend and then had a baby with him, who was 4 days old at the time of the murders. On November 13, 2018, Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine announced the charges against the Wagner family. Billy and Angela, their sons Jake and George, were arrested for plotting and carrying out the murders. And Angela's mother, Rita Newcomb, was arrested as well, along with Frederica Wagner, Billy's mother. They were charged with perjury and obstructing justice, among other crimes. In time, the charges against Frederica Wagner were dismissed. Rita Newcomb pleaded guilty to obstructing official business in connection with the investigation. She agreed to cooperate with prosecutors. And on the 5-year anniversary of the murders, Jake withdrew his not guilty pleas and made a deal with the state.
What plea do you wish to enter to aggravated murder as charged in count 1?
I am guilty, Your Honor.
Jake pleaded guilty to a litany of charges, including 8 counts of aggravated murder. In exchange for prosecutors not pursuing the death penalty, Jake agreed to cooperate and testify against his family. He led investigators to where the family had hid the murder weapons, as well as to a pickup truck they had purchased specifically to use in the murders. He received a sentence of 8 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. On September 10th, 2021, his mom, Angela, pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit aggravated murder and other charges. Angela would eventually receive a sentence of 30 years behind bars. She, too, agreed to cooperate with prosecutors. After those pleadings and dismissals, charges against 2 of the Wagners remained. Jake's brother, George Wagner, pleaded not guilty to 22 charges against him. And their father, Billy, also pleaded not guilty to 22 charges. Billy and George would go to trial for one of the most horrific mass murders in Ohio history. Court Junkie is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, Court Junkies, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join the over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
All month long on Pluto TV, stream the biggest Tyler Perry movies free. Watch your favorites like Madea's Witness Protection and Madea's Big Happy Family. Join Tyler Perry as he goes on a couples retreat with Sharon Leal in Why Did I Get Married? Or Idris Elba and Gabrielle Union in the Tyler Perry-directed film Daddy's Little Girls. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies and TV shows available on live and on demand. Download the free Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in. Watch free.
On September 12, 2022, George Wagner's trial commenced in Pike County, Ohio. Patty Gallagher Newberry covered it for the Cincinnati Inquirer. According to prosecutors, the mass murder of the Roden family began with a custody dispute between Jake Wagner and Hannah Roden over their three-year-old daughter.
So the relationship frays and eventually ends. And Hannah Roden starts seeing other young men, and Jake Wagner really can't let go.
Prosecutor Angela Canepa laid out the details in her opening statements. She told the jury how George's family members, including Jake, would be testifying against him. As part of Jake's plea deal, the death penalty was taken off the table for not only him, but for the rest of his family, as long as he agreed to testify against them.
That said, we sat down with him and he told us what had happened. And I will say that we were right about the majority of it. The majority of it being that, he dated Hannah, he fell in love with her. He was very upset when they parted ways. He wanted her very much to come back to him. He, you know, was certainly jealous. But also that the idea to kill these people did not initiate with him. He was definitely a willing participant. He will tell you that his dad was the first to broach the subject with him. And under the idea that Hannah Mae was dating people that they didn't approve of, and that she was letting Sophia be around people that were not good people.
She said Jake told them there was also a concern among their family that Jake and Hannah's daughter had been molested and that no one in the Roden family was doing anything to stop it. This is something that Angela Wagner would later testify to. Now, she didn't have any proof of this. She didn't go to a doctor or to authorities. But according to prosecutors, she nagged and nagged the rest of her family to do something about the situation. Jake would later testify that he didn't believe the little girl had been molested, but that just because it hadn't happened yet didn't mean it wasn't going to. He thought Hannah was letting her be around men who would molest her in the future. And so soon they decided that the only way to get custody of the little girl was to kill Hannah. Prosecutor Canepa told the jury that 4 months prior to the murders, Hannah was talking to the mom of George's ex-wife, Tabitha, over Facebook Messenger. Tabitha and George had recently split and were also going through their own issues. However, Tabitha had signed a custody document, basically signing the rights of her child with George over to him. Tabitha's mom advised Hannah not to do what Tabitha did with her daughter. Hannah responded, "I won't sign papers ever. They'll have to kill me first." According to Prosecutor Canepa, these messages were being monitored by Angela Wagner. 1 month later, the murder plot began. Prosecutor Canepa said at first the plan was just to kill Hannah Mae, but then the idea snowballed, and they agreed they had to kill Hannah Mae, Frankie, Little Chris, and Big Chris. Those were their main targets. They then made the decision that if there were other people there in addition to them, they would kill them too. Keep in mind that it took more than 6 years for this case to get to trial, but any observer paying attention to the proceedings had to be aware of the disadvantages facing George Wagner. For one, his family members testified against him, saying that there was indeed a plot to kill the Rodens, and that he was, in fact, a part of both the planning and the execution. Jake Wagner testified and gave graphic details of the murders. He opted out of being on camera, so there's no footage available from his actual testimony. Anjanette Levy from Law and Crime, however, was inside the courtroom and later spoke on their YouTube channel about it.
Jake Wagner talks about carrying out these murders like I would talk to you about doing my laundry. He is very flat. He just answers questions. He said that he felt he had no other choice but to kill Hannah Mae Roden, and that his father told him, if you kill Hannah Mae, you have to kill her dad, Chris Sr., who was his father, Billy Wagner's best friend, supposedly. And then you have to kill her brothers and you have to kill her uncle, Kenneth, because they will know you did it and they will come after you like, quote, a sniper on a hill.
Jake told the jury that George went with Jake and Billy to the killings. As the three were on their way there in the pickup truck, Billy pulled over and asked Jake if he really wanted to go through with it. They continued on. Jake said he personally shot and killed five of the victims and wounded a sixth, Chris Roden Sr. He said George was supposed to shoot Chris, but he didn't pull the trigger, and so Jake did instead, shooting him once. But he said his father actually finished him off, killing Chris Roden Sr., his supposed best friend, Gary Roden, and Kenneth Roden. According to Anjanette Levy, during a sidebar, Jake looked over at members of the Roden family who were there in the courtroom and mouthed the words, "I'm sorry." On cross-examination, he admitted that during his proffer, he said George had tried to talk him out of it. Both Jake and their mom, Angela, however, testified that George was also involved in the plotting and cover-up of the killings. Angela, too, declined to be recorded as she testified. She admitted to the jury that she had planned the murders. Rita Newcomb, Angela's mother, told the court that Angela had asked her to lie to police and say that she had notarized and signed custody documents that were found by investigators. The custody documents, which were fake, claimed that an agreement had been reached between Jake and Hannah that said Jake would get full custody of their daughter in the event of Hannah's death. Rita testified that she had not notarized them, but agreed to lie for her daughter. After the murders, in 2017, the Wagner family packed up their things, sold their farm, and moved to Alaska. While there, Jake met Elizabeth Armour. They had a whirlwind romance and got married in March 2018. The family, including Elizabeth, then moved back to Pike County. Elizabeth, who was now divorced from Jake, testified that at one point, Angela accused her of having intentionally food poisoned the children after she had cooked the family tacos. Angela alleged that the kids had diarrhea and were sick, but Elizabeth said no one else saw that. At another point, she said Jake told her that Angela believed she had inappropriately touched Jake's daughter. She told the court that Jake said that because of that allegation, George was uncomfortable with her living there in the same house as his child, and so she would have to go live somewhere else. She recalled a conversation she had with both Jake and Angela about it.
So it was sort of like a showdown. I was called into the kitchen. Jake said that he didn't believe I had done it, but that, you know, I needed to explain myself because Angela believed that she was acting very high and mighty, so to speak. And I was very shocked. And I remember Jake questioning me very sternly, like, did you do this? And he laid it out very clearly to me that if I had done it, that that the right thing to do would be to create Lucille, the baseball bat from The Walking Dead, and string me up in the barn beat me to death with the baseball bat, bulldoze the barn, burn it down, and hunt down and kill my family, and that if he didn't do it, his mom would do it. If his mom didn't do it, his dad would do it, or George would do it, or Billy, or, you know, he just kept saying any of them would be willing to do this because it would be the right thing to do.
She said after that, she packed her bag, called a former police officer friend in Alaska, and made plans to immediately leave. She said she was afraid they were going to kill her. Prosecutors also presented evidence that included a tattoo that George had gotten on his shoulder after the murders, of a skull and an eight ball, which investigators said may have represented the eight victims. And bloody shoe prints from the crime scenes matched the shoe sizes worn by Jake and George. They also matched the style of shoes Angela had purchased days prior to the murders. Shell casings had been recovered from the Wagner home that matched spent cartridges found at one of the crime scenes. There was also a Google search found on Jake's cell phone backup from about 4 hours prior to the murders. The search was for the ding-dong motherfucker seen from the movie Boondock Saints 2. In the clip, the actors kick in a door and shoot someone in the head. And then prosecutors introduced wiretap recordings of the Wagners from their phones and from one of their cars from before they were arrested. In one, they discussed investigators searching their farm after they had sold it so they could move to Alaska. Another conversation was between Angela and her mother, Rita Newcomb. Angela urged Rita to call the tip line for the murders and to implicate the Manley family, Dana Roden's family.
Yeah. Hey, listen, don't get upset. I'm already upset myself. I'll tell you something. You know what you can do? I can't do it because I got an attorney. I'll tell you what you can do. You can call that tip line and you can tell them that we didn't do it and that you're my mom and that you know what they're doing and that they need to stop because they're just deliberately trying to ruin our lives. Now, who am I supposed to call? The tip line is on there. You can do it. You can call in there. Mickey can call in there. It doesn't have to be just a tip on bad stuff. It could be a tip on telling them you know what they're doing. And that Leonard Manley is a greedy old man that just wants the money from Sophie. That's what he wants. Sophie stands to get $50,000. And he wants the money because Chris used to pay all his bills and there's no money left for him. They're freaking poor people. I'm not picking on them, but they're like white trash, Mom. They live in trailers and they're freaking filthy, disgusting, and they live off of Chris. And if they have Sophie, they get all her inheritance money, which is $50,000 or more.
Oh, my goodness.
The state seemingly had a mountain of evidence pointing to George Wagner's guilt. So how was George's defense team planning on combating it? Patty described how it seemed from the courtroom.
I was there for 48 of 51 trial dates. At the beginning of George Wagner's trial, his defense team, in their opening statement, told jurors that George Wagner was home on the night of the murders, that he went to bed around 10 a.m., that he learned about the homicides the next day when his brother took a call and was told about the murders. Later, it was said when George took the stand in his own defense, he said he learned about the murders when he watched the news the next day and expressed, you know, shock and dismay that his family would be accused of these. So at the beginning of the trial, George Wagner and his attorneys maintained and asserted that George had nothing to do with the murders. He didn't know about the murders. He was home asleep. He thought his family was innocent. And furthermore, he was trying to separate from his family because he found them to be, you know, toxic. So, you know, as a journalist, I'm sitting in court and I'm listening to that.
When George took the stand, he said he was not aware of the murder plot.
Were you aware at any time that Jake and your dad and your mom were planning to kill the Rodens?
No.
Was that ever discussed with you?
No.
Did you have any idea that was going to happen?
No.
He testified that he considered Hannah Mae to be like a little sister. They used to talk about everything from hunting, fishing, to any issues they were going through. He said they would both confide in each other.
Under any circumstances, would you kill Hannah?
No.
Would you assist somebody else in killing Hannah?
No.
He said he had believed that the family was being framed, something that he said Angela said too.
After listening to these recordings that we heard in court, how do you feel about what Jake was saying and what you now know he did?
I now know that he was just lying through his teeth to me.
What about your mother?
Same thing. She was lying to me from the beginning.
Did you ever tell your mother, referencing these recordings, did you ever tell your mother you would take the blame for these murders?
No, I did not.
While sitting in the courtroom, Patty had the perspective of a journalist with no foregone conclusions about where the trial might go.
I'm new to the case at that point. I'm like, okay, that's interesting. Let's see where this goes. And so I kept expecting that at some point the defense would bring in witnesses that would verify George Wagner's version of events on April 21 and 22 in 2016. But they didn't. There were no witnesses that backed up George Wagner's version of where he was and what he did that night, except himself. He took the stand in his own defense late in the trial, and he told that tale to the jurors.
On cross-examination, George was questioned further about his alibi and about what he told agents when he and his family were questioned at the border when they came back from Alaska through Canada.
You said that the night of the homicides, you went to bed at 10 o'clock.
10-ish, if I remember correctly. It's been a long time.
Okay. And you said that was your usual bedtime.
Usually somewhere around there.
Okay. All right. And so do you recall, again, being interviewed at the border and saying that the four of you, well, the six of you, actually, your mom, your dad, your brother, yourself, Sophia and Bovine, were watching a movie and you were up until, you didn't go to bed till 12:30.
I don't remember what time it was.
Okay. Do you remember telling the border, at the border, the agents, when they asked you about what you did that night, you saying that your mom had fixed cheeseburgers for you and how delicious they were and she makes the best and maybe one day she could make them for them?
I don't remember that now. Okay. I'm not saying I didn't say that. I just said I don't remember.
Okay.
Although George insisted he was innocent, the lack of corroborating witnesses and the insistence of his own family members that he wasn't seemed to say otherwise.
But by then, there had been such overwhelming evidence about his participation that it really belied belief that he was not there, that he was not aware, that he did not buy certain ballistics and guns and other kinds of supplies, that he did not help cover up, etc. You know, so I went into it as any journalist would. Okay, let's hear what we've got going on here. His side says he's innocent, knew nothing about it. The prosecution says he's all in. Let's hear which version is true. So that's what happened. That you know, the defense brought, I don't know, 10 or 12 witnesses overall, but none of them corroborated George Wagner's version of what happened that night.
The jury wasn't very sympathetic to George either.
The jury found him guilty on each and every count.
It's an audible gasp inside the courtroom from the Roden family as soon as the judge read the first guilty verdict of aggravated murder, and then tears followed. It would be followed by seven other aggravated murder charges, all guilty against George Wagner.
At his sentencing hearing this past December, members of the Roden family spoke to the court.
I hope you burn in hell, George. I hope every night when you close your eyes, you see them eight faces, and I hope they haunt you.
They don't want to die. How ironic is that? Well, karma drives a big bus, and you will eventually reap what you have been sown, and you will pay the price for what you have done.
No sentence
that the court may impose in this case would right the wrong that has been inflicted upon the victims.
It was a lot to take in.
George Wagner sat there stoically, barely looking up, not acknowledging any of their statements in any kind of direct way. And then after sentencing, he maintained that same stoic appearance as he was let out of court. And of course, he never said anything to anyone. The most that media interacted with him was being 6 feet behind him in the court or seeing him come be led in or out of the back door of the courthouse.
A judge sentenced George to serve 8 consecutive life sentences in prison without the possibility of parole. He was 31 years old.
So that happened just on December 19. And then here we are as the new year starts and Billy Wagner is moving forward with his case. There is an off chance that he might also flip and decide to take a plea from the state of Ohio, but not many people think that's likely. So he's going forward to trial.
Court proceedings towards Billy's trial have only just begun. An actual trial date has not yet been set as of this recording. Patty Gallagher covered more of the proceedings in this case for the Cincinnati Inquirer than just about anyone in the country. And it was one of the most alarming, heartbreaking cases anyone could follow. So after trial, we asked her if she had any thoughts that she took away from the proceedings.
It was a privilege to cover this case for the state of Ohio. The state of Ohio paid $4 million so far, and it's not done yet, to bring this case against the Wagner family. And so I'm a strong proponent in being a watchdog kind of journalist, being the eyes and the ears of the public. And I was proud that my employer, Gannett, kept me over there for the duration and that we shared our coverage with all 21 news outlets in the state of Ohio. It was a horrific case to sit through. There were days where I took out a tissue and cried along with the victim families. Seeing autopsy photos in court, close-ups of gunshot wounds that were still bloody, pictures of a six-month-old covered in crusted blood from his own parents. Those are images that will never leave me. But, you know, I am but one lowly scribe. It will never leave the imaginations and the nightmares of this family and this community. So, you know, my trauma is minuscule, right? My reaction is inconsequential. This family was devastated. This community was devastated. This state was devastated by this horrific, unspeakable crime. I put in a Facebook post. I was able to pour my emotion and grief onto the page. I wrote about it every day. That's how I processed it, right? I saw it. I transcribed it. I put it in my stories to the extent I thought it was appropriate. I don't have nightmares, but I'm damn sure that members of the Roden family still have nightmares.
Patty, thank you so much for talking with us. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched by Nicole Gusmerati and Matt Stroud, and written by Matt Stroud, who interviewed Patty Gallagher for the show. Please consider subscribing to Court Junkie if you haven't already, and if you haven't heard of our new sister podcast, Civil, covering cases and trials outside the criminal justice system, please check out and subscribe to that too. Search for Civil and Court Junkie wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.
If you're looking for another surprising investigation into the criminal justice system, check out Bear Brook from New Hampshire Public Radio, hosted by me, Jason Moon. 5 years ago, the first season of Bear Brook was named one of the best true crime podcasts by Vulture. Now we're back with a new season and a new case and a new look at the power of true crime storytelling. In 1989, New Hampshire police charged three men with conspiring to murder a pregnant woman. But only 19-year-old Jason Carroll was convicted. Now, Jason is serving life in prison for a murder he says he didn't commit. The only evidence against him? His own taped confession. More than 30 years later, is it still possible to get to the truth? And who gets to tell it? Listen to Season 2 of Bear Brook on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.